It is 8:30. We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
I throw you off there with doing the plug for Preaching the Blues.
I meant to do
the positive vibes one.
Confused.
All right. Let's start out with local and Council Member Burgess. Trying to push for some...
What about him?
Some new laws.
Yeah, Council Member Burgess perhaps regretting that he didn't run for mayor as he initially decided he was going to do last year and then pulled out because he didn't think anybody could beat
Joe
Greg
Mallinette.
Nichols. And and his judgment hasn't gotten any better. He, although his media coverage is certainly still favorable, he rolled out a plan on Thursday that he'd been working on for several months, actually, to criminalize panhandling downtown. This isn't what it's called, of course. It's called an aggressive panhandling ordinance. But what it in fact would do, it is written so broadly, if you actually sit down and read the text, which apparently most local media coverage did not bother to do, it would essentially outlaw almost any solicitation downtown, including the Girl Scouts, including Real Change newspaper. You probably can't listen to KEXP's Pledge Drive on the radio, you know, out loud. When you're within 15 feet of somebody in an ATM machine or somebody who's paying for parking. Well, of course, the problem with
Which is most streets downtown.
The problem with that is that if you have your little sticker in your hand and are taking it to a pay machine for the parking meter, the way that works now, that would probably fall under the ordinance. So it effectively bans all types of solicitation anywhere in any commercial district, not just downtown, but almost anywhere in the city where there's parking meters. It's an incredibly badly written ordinance, and that's just one of the problems. I mean, it's number one is that it's a solution in search of a problem. In that the main force behind this, the Conservative Downtown Seattle Association, which lost its main advocate last year when Jan Drago retired, and has apparently picked up a new champion in Burgess. Their own figures from their own study shows that this is not unlike what Burgess' press releases claimed. A growing problem downtown. If anything, it's not much of a problem at all. And the actual problem that keeps a lot of people who don't live or work downtown from shopping downtown isn't aggressive panhandling. It's the lack of the difficulty with traffic getting downtown and the lack of affordable parking, because most people, of course, still use their own cars rather than public transit. The other thing that's interesting about this is that it's being sold as being part of an overall plan to reduce homelessness. Well, this is kind of problematic also, because the pieces of the proposal that Burgess is touting that would be social service components, additional social services, more community service officers and the police and so forth, these were proposals that were already standing as part of other legislation. He's piggybacking onto them to basically try and push what we here locally like to call Sidran ordinances in honor of the man who first populated them popularized them in the 1990s. It's real problematic, and it looks very likely that it's going to go through just based on how many people on city councils have spoken in favor of it so far and the largely favorable reaction to it in local media. The problem with this, of course, is that it, you know, once again is scoring easy, cheap political points by demonizing the poor while not actually solving any real problems. So hopefully in the process of being considered by city council, they can at least change the wording so it's not worded so broadly that it would outlaw Girl Scouts from selling Girl Scout cookies downtown, because right now that's what it would do, and it's a real problem.
Actually, I have a lot more trouble with the Girl Scouts than I do with
Yeah, and I think
the,
I think really
well, it's a more it's part of the drug dealing problem is what that is. Sugar, it's bad for you.
I think what also sparked this ordinance too is the number of people who loiter downtown on the sidewalks as well, and the perception that the fact that there are a lot of people who are not just homeless but also people who are poor who can't afford to hang out in stores or coffee shops to buy stuff in order to find a place to sit down or to just be during the day, and who don't have jobs because of course there are a lot of people out of work right now. It really is not a solution. This is really not a solution to that problem. The solution to that problem is to find a place for people to go where they can go.
And presumably public spaces are for that. The public spaces are for
supposedly
the public. If you want a private space in which to go shopping, go to Bellevue Square. That's what it's for. We don't need another Bellevue Square in downtown Seattle.
Well, the city parks have long been a place where people have been pushed out, because you don't want the city parks to be used for people to actually go there and hang out, because, there might be, you know, drug activity there. People might decide to camp out there or whatever.
They might smoke.
Yeah, they might smoke, they might spit, they might do these things that the city is increasingly making illegal behavior. When you've got people who need a place to go and you're closing down the public libraries for a couple of days every week, you're making it really hard for people to gather someplace that's free, where they don't have to spend money. And if you criminalize that behavior on the city sidewalks, the problem's not going to go away. It's just going to be this endless push and pull between the poor and the police.
Yeah, and that is what this comes down to, because we all know that the police are not about to rouse the Girl Scouts for that, unless of course they're politically forced to, just to be fair. But what this in practice will mean is it gives the police one more tool with which to rouse somebody that they don't like the looks of. And that almost invariably means somebody who's poor and or homeless.
And just simply out of work,
yeah.
A lot of these folks.
All right, let's move on to the City Council came up with some priorities this week.
Yeah, this week the City Council announced their list of priorities for 2010, and no surprise at the top of the list was they want to move forward to replace the viaduct with a downtown traffic tunnel, and they want to move forward on the 520 bridge. They want to break ground on it. They were kind of wishy-washy. They didn't come out and say, well, we support the mayor's efforts to help neighborhoods change the design on the 520 bridge. But they did come out and say, well, we support the city's efforts to make the 520 bridge design more amenable to local groups and communities in the city. So they're saying, you know, we want to get these transportation things done, but we're not really gonna push for the changes that might make them more popular to people who live within the city, or might make them more workable for folks who actually live in Seattle. Also on the list was and this kind of got me, because this is a year when you would think the city council would be wanting to save money, but on the list they also included they want to decide on a route for the First Hill streetcar, which is like saying, gosh, why don't we just take on a whole nother big project that's going to be a money hole.
And once again, this shows how addicted this city is to big ticket projects as opposed to simple social services and the sorts of nitty gritty things that help a city run.
Yeah. There were other things on the priority list too. Like, for example, they want to write a plan to make the city carbon neutral. That's really a code word for encouraging increasing density and increasing building heights in city neighborhoods. They also want to expand community gardens and local food production, although I don't know how that's going to square with this idea of making neighborhoods more dense and building heights taller.
You build 55-story buildings and then put a garden on top. It's closer to the sun.
Because God knows, you know, that vacant lot next to the 55-story building isn't going to get any sun.
No, you pave that over and you turn that into a parking lot.
Yes, or a parking garage. and they included a few other things, too, like pushing for reforms in schools, which really is not a purview of the city council. And they also listed trying to avoid cuts in social services, although that was fairly far down on the list, and I'm not sure how they're going to be able to keep that promise when they want to start building a First Hill streetcar anyway.
All right. Moving on to our state legislature, which only has, what, another couple weeks to go?
Yeah, I think only.
Yeah, then we abolish it, and then life is better.
But, the Senate and the House have finally released the broad outlines of their budget plans. The Senate on Tuesday announced a plan where they actually specified what their increase in revenue would be and what it would come from, whereas the House specified an increase in revenue but didn't have any particular plans on how to get that money. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the Senate. The Senate wants to increase revenue to the state by $918 million. As part of that plan, they want to close about $518 million in tax loopholes, which I guess is a start on closing some of the tax loopholes, which have amounted to what, about $12 billion in the state budget.
Yes, that is correct.
In addition, the Senate,
which is about five times the actual budget shortfall.
Yeah,
this year.
Exactly. And in addition, the Senate wants to increase the sales tax by 0.3%. And in addition, in order to offset that for the poor, they want to fund the working families tax rebate with $33 million. Although I'm not sure if that's going to be adequate to offset the increase in sales tax. They also want to increase cigarette taxes by about a buck a pack, and that is the only sin tax that they included in their plan. So they didn't include the other proposals that Gregoire made to put a tax on bottled water and on sodas and that sort of thing. And the House said that they want to increase the revenue to the state by $857 million. But again, as I said, they gave no details, although both of these plans seem to plug a little bit more of the hole than Gregoire's plan did, which would have increased the state revenues by $600 million. They come nowhere near plugging the almost $3 billion hole in the budget. So there are a number of cuts that we're going to see in the state budget if any of these plans go through. And some of those cuts include things like cutting grants to community health clinics that treat uninsured patients. They would suspend money for school class size reductions that were approved by voter initiative. They would cut long-term care for people with disabilities and senior citizens, and some of those people would lose their long-term care entirely. They would make drastic cuts to the basic health plan and may eventually eliminate the program entirely. Basic health plan provides insurance coverage for people in the state of Washington who don't have access to private insurance. They would also make cuts in a number of educational programs for higher education, including the work-study program that allows working students who cannot afford to go to college. It allows them to continue to pay tuition. Those are some of the things we would lose if the Senate and House Democrats don't step up to the plate and find some more revenue.
All right. Anything else on that, or moving on to?
Well, I just want to say that the only tax reform measures that are even being discussed, really, in addition to closing a few small loopholes in the state's revenue, is to perhaps put forward a bill that would impose an automatic expiration date for tax breaks that have been set in the past. I think that's a really good idea, an automatic sunset provision for tax breaks that the legislature gives to businesses. Those things ought to have an expiration date on them, and the legislature ought to have to sit down and say and evaluate and say, do we need to extend this? What was the benefit? What were the drawbacks?
All right.
But that's still just a proposal at this point.
And it still doesn't address the problem for this year.
No, it doesn't.
Well, speaking of problems for this year, let's move on to national and this week's healthcare summit.
Yeah, if the state abolishes its basic health plan and abolishes community clinics and makes it that much more difficult for people to get healthcare and to afford healthcare, don't look for a whole lot of relief from the feds either. We had the spectacle this week of a healthcare summit, which was basically a PR opportunity that the Obama administration should have done months ago, whereby they invited the Republicans to the White House and said, here's our plan, we'll put our plan on the table, you put your plan on the table, and we'll have a dialogue. Well, of course, the Republicans don't actually have a cohesive plan. What they want is the status quo, which is double-digit inflation every year for health insurance companies and the private market to rule all. They make some noises about things like, malpractice suit reform and things like that, but that doesn't really address the problems that most real Americans actually have, which is the cost of healthcare and the availability of healthcare and the cost of healthcare insurance. And the Republicans really had nothing to say, and this was an opportunity for most of this country to actually get the notion that all the Republicans are doing is trying to stall and that they are going to vote no against anything anything at all, no matter how conciliatory, that the Democrats propose. And many of the ideas that the Democrats are now championing were at one time Republican ideas. This whole concept of healthcare exchanges, for example, as opposed to a public option, which was only mentioned in the context of being trashed during the healthcare summit. But the whole idea of healthcare exchanges was originally a Republican idea. The Republicans are now opposed to it because the Obama administration is proposing it. So the reality seems to have sunk in for at least some of the Democrats, although certainly not all of them, and certainly not mainstream media, that no matter what the Democrats propose, the Republicans are just going to oppose it. So it looks like they're going to go ahead and try and use the reconciliation process to get, which only requires 51 votes, to get the very weak, watered-down health care reform that, that we are left with through the Senate in the coming weeks. But if this had happened 6 months ago, we might have a much more robust bill. However, it didn't, and we don't.
Yeah, and the Congress might be able to move on to working on some other issues.
Jobs, for example.
Well, they passed a jobs bill, something that both the Democrats and the Republicans in Congress can actually agree on. And, of course, what was in that jobs bill was primarily gifts to businesses, totaling about $15 billion. $13 billion of it was an exemption from payroll tax on new hires, new unemployed people that you hire through the end of 2010. It would also include a $1,000 tax credit for companies that keep new workers on the payroll for a full year. And it would extend the bonus Section 179 expense deduction, which, as translated for most people, means it would allow businesses to write off up to $250,000 in capital or asset purchases in 2010 instead of depreciating them over time, which is what businesses had to do in the past. So essentially just giving away some money to their business buddies. I'd also like to mention that although Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, wrote the bill, this bill replaced an originally $85 billion jobs bill that would have given even more tax breaks to big businesses. So it sort of seems to be the lesser of two evils at this point.
Which can still be pretty darn evil.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you had the spectacle of, for people who don't have jobs right now, the Senate, was poised this week to vote, in favor of yet another unemployment benefits extension. Now this is something that was so uncontroversial that it passed the House on a voice vote, but it was filibustered by the Republicans, and this may be one of my all-time favorite let them eat cake, quotes from a politician. This comes from, Senator Jim Bunning of Kentucky, the former Major League Baseball pitcher, turned, well, he probably always was an idiot, but it's become more public since he's become a U.S. Senator. He's retiring, so he doesn't really care what anybody thinks at this point. He led the filibuster against the extension on the unemployment benefits and complained during the process of the filibuster that it was causing him to miss watching a basketball game on TV. True story. These are the people making decisions that affect our daily lives.
These are people making decisions, yes, about whether or not you can have health insurance.
Yep.
Wow.
Or unemployment benefits that you help pay for.
Yep.
All right, moving from that high note to this week's economic news.
Yeah, this week the FDIC announced that the list of troubled banks had topped 700 in the U.S., which they think means that they have reached a peak in problems with the banking industry. I'm not sure how they measure that, but they expect this year that they will have to cover about $20 billion in losses for failed banks in 2010. But I just want to point out that last year the FDIC covered, you know, if you think about it conservatively, covered about $37.5 billion in losses last year. So if we're reaching the peak of the number of banks on the troubled bank list and you can expect a certain proportion of those to fail as they did last year, I don't see how that means that the FDIC is going to shell out less this year than they did last year. So it seems to me somebody's underestimating how much the FDIC is going to need in its fund. Anyway, more news on bank lending. There was a report that bank lending fell by $587 billion, or by 7.5% last year in 2009. That's the largest decline since the Great Depression. Some folks might say, well, banks need to lend less money because we've been in a credit binge lately. FDIC Chair Sheila Bair, however, said that it was mostly big banks that were responsible for the fall in lending, not small banks, who tend to make up the bulk of the banks on the most troubled list that the FDIC keeps. And I want to point out that, ironically, it's the big banks that posted most of the big profits for 2009.
And also the big banks that got most of the bailout money, which was specifically intended so that they could lend money
out
to
yes.
consumers.
Yes, exactly. But banking news wasn't the only economic news this week. We had a lot of news about the housing market, which is kind of interesting because with the extension of the first-time home buyer's credit to April 30th and the extension of that credit to anyone who wanted to buy a house, not just first-time home buyers, economists expected a huge surge in home sales. From December through March. And what they're finding is that's not the case. The Commerce Department reported this week that new home sales fell to the lowest level since they have started keeping records in 1963, new home sales in January, that is, and that they're seeing a corresponding drop in February. In January, it was an 11.2% drop. Now, new homes only make up a tiny fraction of the home sales market, so, of course, to get a bigger picture, you have to look at the sales of existing homes. Well, this week, the National Association of Realtors said that sales of existing homes dropped by 7.2% in January, also a very, very large drop. This is when, this is when economists have been forecasting an increase in sales. And I want to point out that this was the third consecutive month of declines in the sales of new homes. So you might be asking some questions like, why is this happening when the first-time home buyer's credit became a home buyer's credit, so anybody could take advantage of it, and it had an impact on the fall housing market by pushing sales up. Why isn't it pushing sales up now? Well, you could say maybe it's the cold weather. You know, maybe it's because prices were run up in the fall and they haven't dropped and people are bargain hunting. Or you could say, well, people are out of work and they just don't have the money. That's true, too. Or you could say maybe we've begun a second slide in the housing market.
Or all of the above.
Yeah, or as I would like to say, yes, all of the above and probably a few things more, like maybe it's harder to borrow money than it used to be.
All right. That moves us on then to international and developments in Afghanistan.
Yeah. President Karzai took over the Election Complaint Commission this week. The Election Complaint Commission is a 5-member body that oversees elections in Afghanistan, hears complaints of fraud, and it makes decisions on how those complaints will be handled. During the last presidential election last year, it determined that about 1 million of President Karzai's votes in the election were fraudulent, and by throwing out those 1 million votes, it forced him into a runoff. Fortunately for him, he didn't have to go through that runoff when his opponent decided that it was a pointless exercise and that he would just be subject to fraud again and would probably lose the election. And Karzai was declared the winner of the election by a commission that he controlled. And so it shouldn't be any surprise now that he's found a way to manipulate the Constitution to seize control of the Election Complaint Commission and fire the 3 foreign members of the organization who were appointed by the UN and replace them with his own members. So that's I find to be fascinating news.
Yeah. Meanwhile, on the battlefield this week, a lot going on. The U.S., of course, continuing to prosecute its offensive in Marja, which nobody can really tell whether that's working or not for any of its stated goals, at least its stated military goals, as opposed to its stated PR goals, which seem to be going along just swimmingly in terms of laudatory U.S. coverage. We seem to keep seeing, at this point, for several weeks in a row, exultory articles talking about how the U.S. has taken over Marja. Well, it keeps happening. It's the oddest thing.
It happens, and then it happens again, and then it has to happen again.
This week there was a big ceremony where the Afghan government hoisted its flag in Marja on Thursday, so start your stopwatches on that one for how long it lasts. Because the point of all of these has never been the question of whether the U.S. has the military firepower to take over a particular piece of real estate for any length of time. Of course it does. The question is whether they can hang on to that, and whether the puppet Afghan government of Karzai, which has very little legitimacy in its actual homeland, whether they can hang on to it after the troops move on to their next destination. And we found out today what the next destination, or this week what the next destination is. The U.S. military announced, similar to its announcing months ahead of time, that it was going to go into Marja, that it wants to go into Kandahar this summer. That is going to be a major offensive and a major battle, and much bigger, and it is also going to happen before we can see any evidence whatsoever of whether these areas that are seized can actually be held on to over the long term, and whether it's worthwhile. This comports with the Obama administration's timeline, talking about how we want to make a judgment on whether the surge is working by next summer, in order to figure out whether to draw down troops or whether to continue the war indefinitely, although all signs at this point are that it's going to be continued indefinitely.
Yeah, and let's not forget why they're seizing this territory. They're seizing it in order to impose the Afghan central government on these folks, a central government that is riddled with corruption, as you can see by the move this week that Karzai made to seize the Election Complaint Commission. And also, when you're talking about Kandahar, moving into Kandahar, guess who the Afghan government's main representative is in Kandahar? That would be Hamid Karzai's brother, who has very close connections to the opium drug trade.
As well as the CIA.
Yeah, as well as the CIA.
All right. Also, there's continued airstrikes this week.
Yes, 33 civilians killed in the latest If a Tree Falls mass murder by American planes in Afghanistan. And once again, the Afghan population is up outraged by it, and Americans yawned.
Yeah. All right.
And we wonder why hearts and minds aren't following suit.
All right, just 2 minutes left. Colombia situation.
Yeah, speaking of the legitimacy of governments that want to perpetuate themselves, the Colombian Supreme Court ruled 7-2 this week, blocking Alvaro Uribe from seeking a third term. Now, you may remember all of the huffing and puffing that went on both with the U.S. government and U.S. media when Latin American leftists like Hugo Chavez and Zelaya in Honduras, who didn't even actually want another term, were accused of wanting to perpetuate indefinite rule and set up a dictatorship for very similar types of endeavors. You know, they're becoming another Hitler and so forth. Well, here you have somebody who has very close ties to the paramilitary right wing in Colombia.
I believe he ran his own death squad.
He ran his own death squad. The country with the worst human rights record by far in Latin America, worse than Cuba even, by far. And yet the American government, the American media has been very, very quiet on this. This story was almost nowhere to be found in U.S. media this week.
All right. And very briefly, do you have time to go into Iraq? Or
Let's hold that for next week.
Okay, we'll hold that till next week. How about some events?
Yeah, three of them to talk about this week. Today at 1 o'clock is the ACLU's annual membership conference with the keynote speaker, Jan Steely, talking about surveillance. And you might as well go because they already know you're planning to. That'll be 1 o'clock at MOHAI, the Museum of History and Industry in Montlake. Tomorrow from 1:30 to 3:30, there is a rally to support Travis Bishop. He is an imprisoned GI resistor at Fort Lewis. That rally will be at the Freedom Bridge, so-called, exit 122 off of I-5 near the Coffee Strong Coffee House. And then Monday from 6 to 8 o'clock, Nova High School students are going to be fundraising, doing an auction and dinner for their annual social justice trip to Guatemala. So please turn out to Nova High School in the CD to support that, 6 to 8 on Monday night.
All right. And don't forget about tonight, there is the Physicians for National Health Program annual public meeting happening at Kane Hall at 7 p.m. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This State. And where do people find Eat This State?
Eat This State comes out every couple of weeks. You can find it where you find free publications, at least for the time being, at coffee stores and bookshops and King County Library System and so forth. We will have a new website soon, and you can still see the old one if you want to see what 1990s websites look like. But all the content is there. It works just fine. It's at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have comments, questions, tips, feedback, and want to volunteer, any of that good stuff, you can reach us at info@eatthestate.org by email or voicemail by phone at area code 206-719-6947.